Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 30th of December. In his piece in the Current Atlantic, James Fallows does what he believes the president, Congress, and all Americans should do: take the military seriously. Don't let it run on autopilot. Give it serious external scrutiny. Make it accountable. Determine why the best equipped fighting force in history, and certainly the most expensive, has been defeated by less modern, worse equipped, barely funded foes. The cover piece is titled, "Why Do the Best Soldiers in the World Keep Losing? The Tragic Decline of the American Military." James Fallows is national correspondent for the Atlantic Monthly. He's worked for the magazine for more than 25 years and has written on so many issues: national security policy, American politics, the development and impact of technology, economic trends and patterns. He was, for a couple of years, President Jimmy Carter's chief speechwriter. His first book, National Defense, won the American Book Award in 1981. In the 5 years after the 9/11 attacks, James was based in Washington and wrote many articles about U.S. policies for dealing with terrorism and also about the war in Iraq. He's written a number of books, most recently Blind into Baghdad, I believe this is the latest, America's War in Iraq, which is based on several of his articles in The Atlantic. This is a very, very lengthy, very important article, and we have it on our Facebook page in case it just was released. So if you would like to read it, it's a very long read. It's a very comprehensive and provocative read. So there it is on the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we hope that you'll have a chance to look at it. For you to join our conversation, I would think that some of what he says will make you want to go to your phones, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk at WPR.org. Facebook page, as I said, is the Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and that's at K Dunn Show. James Fallows, always a pleasure to speak with you. Hello.
Kathleen, thanks so much, and thanks for your gracious introduction, which I would amend only to add my two books about China, which were Postcards from Tomorrow Square and China Airborne, I think at least one of which I had the pleasure of speaking with you about, too.
Yes, but you did.
Thanks. It's a great honor to be on your show again.
Yeah, it's wonderful to have you here. And what an important piece. As I read the piece last night, I was thinking, what an important piece this is. And thank goodness somebody is treating this subject with the comprehensiveness that it deserves. You raise so many questions that we as a nation just haven't asked.
Well, I appreciate your reading it, and this is a piece that has been in gestation for a long time. As you mentioned, you know, 35 years ago, I was originally doing writing about the military for the Atlantic, and the premise I had then, right at the beginning of the transition from the Jimmy Carter administration, in which I worked, to the Ronald Reagan administration, was that our debate about the military was too simplistic then. It was either spend more versus spend less. But compared with that era, compared with our current era, that era is like the age of Pericles in terms of the sophistication of and that things. It's just now the main point I was trying to make is we've essentially assumed that referring to everyone in uniform as a hero makes up for paying attention to how we actually spend money, what kind of conditions the troops are in, and all the rest. So that's the point I'm trying to make in this piece.
Well, you use this phrase, chicken hawk nation. You call us that. What is a chicken hawk nation?
I think people are familiar with the term chicken hawk. Probably it came most into vogue just before the Iraq war, to refer to people who were eager for the U.S. to go to war as long as someone else is going, often people who had not themselves been in uniform, as I myself also have not, but were spoiling to have somebody else join the fight. It seemed to me that a condition that you could ascribe to certain individuals 15 years ago has become the national condition now, where in fact we've been in 13 years plus of open-ended warfare. But fewer than 1% of the current American population has served at any time in the last 13 years in Iraq or Afghanistan or other combat theaters. So we have a nation whose public is not at war, but the state itself is always at war. And that seems to me an unwholesome chicken hawk condition.
Mm-hmm. New members of Congress coming in January. You spent some time talking about Seth Moulton, a Marine during the Iraq War, a graduate of Harvard University who thinks everybody ought to serve. I wonder if we'll get a little more scrutiny with some of these new members of Congress.
I think that it's one of the points I make is that back during, in the aftermath of World War II, which was a mass mobilization war, and through even the late Vietnam era, most Americans had some family or firsthand familiarity with the military and knew both the things to respect about it and the things to be skeptical about it. And that's become less and less the case in the era of the volunteer army. I think as we have a rising generation of people who've done service in both Iraq, Afghanistan, or elsewhere, some of whom are entering electoral politics, they'll have more of that firsthand experience. It doesn't mean their views will be identical. Seth Moulton was against the Iraq War, but served four tours there. Tom Cotton, a new Republican senator from Arkansas, was also in Iraq, also a Harvard graduate, and is very much for the Iraq War and various Republican stands. But at least in both cases, they have more personal grounding in their views, which I think is a good thing.
You say some things that make you catch your breath. In 13 years, you write, of continuous combat under the authorization for the use of military force, the longest stretch of warfare in American history, U.S. forces have achieved one clear strategic success, and that's the raid that killed Osama bin Laden. We obviously are having incredible, difficult time fighting ISIS. It's hard to look at many successes, although there may have been a few little strategic successes. It would call out for an examination of what we're doing and the trillions of dollars that it's costing, and yet that doesn't happen. And you were on a commission to give a report to the president about what might be good for us to be doing and looking at the military, and evidently you never heard from the president. How can we have that kind of involvement, that kind of record, and not have a serious examination of what we might be doing wrong?
I think the reason, the answer I suggest to that question that you astutely pose is that we can have, the reason we haven't called for accountability is that so few members of the public are directly involved. Again, I'll give the statistic, which is quite remarkable when you think about it. In 13 years of open-ended war, about 0.75% of the American public has been at any point in that time in uniform or Iraq and Afghanistan. And that's including the reserves, who have been much more involved than in previous areas in American history. And I think that an analogy to think of is if you think other great public institutions affect all of us in one way or another, we all know about the schools, we all know about medical systems, we all know about pollution, we certainly all know about taxes. And things go wrong in all those areas, but there is some crude, at least crude, maybe better than that, democratic feedback mechanism. I think we have postponed accountability for what's gone right and wrong during what's called the long wars because so few people, again, have been compelled to pay direct personal attention. Democracy is based on the idea that people's self-interest motivates them to pay attention to things, and we have avoided having most people be self-interestedly concerned with these wars.
And yet our taxpayer dollars are going into these wars, and the amount of money that we are spending, you highlight the F-35. Where is William Proxmire to give out the Golden Fleece Awards when
Wisconsin's
you need it?
Wisconsin's own, Wisconsin.
Absolutely.
Or Les Aspin, too.
Or Les Aspin, right. We need somebody who will look at what we're spending money on. But you would think that we would be concerned about that. The amount of money that you outline in this article is just astronomically high.
Well, here's one way to think about the F-35, which is a very controversial modern fighter plane built to do three different things at once. That is, to be able to take off straight up and down like a helicopter for the Marine Corps, to be strong enough to land on Navy aircraft carrier decks, and to be maneuverable enough to be an Air Force dogfighter. And all those things, trying to do all those at once has been problematic. The cost of this plane is likely to be at least, even the overruns for it are likely to be 100 times greater than the entire amount of money that was invested in the Solyndra Solar Power Corporation that got so much attention. And yet Solyndra has gotten about 100 times as much press and political discussion. So, again, I think the money, people have been somewhat blunted from paying attention to the monetary impacts of the wars because taxes weren't raised to cover the cost, especially of invading Afghanistan. And indeed, people look on this in the bright side, that many politicians are fighting to have these contracts come to their districts. So if you start thinking of the military as essentially another kind of stimulus program, again, it distorts our democratic systems for thinking about this part of our national life.
I believe you mentioned, wasn't it Bernie Sanders, who's a pretty liberal member of Congress, and even he, who initially was opposed to the F-35, his district evidently is getting some kind of kickback for it. So, you know, why not have it in Vermont?
Yes, this is, I find this charming. I like Bernie Sanders. I agree with his politics on many issues, and he thinks, as I do, that the F-35 is a bad choice for the country, but he's quite outright in saying it's a bad choice, but it's the choice we made, so they're going to be someplace. Why not Vermont?
Right.
So he's fighting to get them. He's fighting local opponents of the plane around Burlington, saying, they say it's too noisy and dangerous. Says, yeah, but it'll bring jobs to Burlington.
You talk about Vietnam. Let's give a little historical reference here. The military itself, you write, recognized its own failures, and a whole generation of reformers looked to understand and change the culture. Why did that happen then? Why is it not happening now? And was the culture changed in some significantly positive way for at least a while?
I think anybody who studies the American history of the last, the American military history of the last 50 years recognizes first the trauma that the U.S. military, in addition to the U.S. public, and of course the Vietnamese public and everybody else, endured during America's decade of conflict in Vietnam, where again, for as a proportional measure, the United States lost at least 50,000 people killed in Vietnam over a decade, and of course many multiples more of Vietnamese who were killed. And in the 15 years after that, you had very, very serious self-examination within the institutional military about how this happened to the country and the military, what the military itself had done wrong in addition to the political mistakes that had led to this this catastrophe for the country and for the world. And so you had a very active generation of reformers at all levels, both weapons designers, people who thought about aircraft, people who thought about the ethics of combat, people who thought about the ethics of leadership, and many of the people who are just now aging out as leaders of the military, people of the Petraeus, McChrystal, Chiarelli generation. They were ones who came up just after Vietnam, and there are all sorts of books. I think there may be that movement within the military after Iraq and Afghanistan. There are some signs on it, but it hasn't yet been as pronounced as that post-Vietnam reform movement was within the military.
And tell me about this working group that you were a part of, Gary Hart's working group. The president approached Gary Hart and asked him to do what?
So Gary Hart, as background, people think of him now, unfortunately, mainly as the presidential candidate who was derailed by the Donna Rice imbroglio and press explosion. I think his role within the military or within American politics is being the most serious Democratic Party student of the military over the last 20 or 30 years. He, 1980s, he was leading a military reform caucus with then his Republican counterparts were the young Congressman Newt Gingrich and the young Congressman Dick Cheney, who agree with him on many of these issues. Gary Hart has remained active as a military informer. In 2011, that is obviously before President Obama had been reelected, the president asked Gary Hart privately to put together a little advisory group on ways in which the president might be able to make large differences in the Pentagon if he won a second term. Gary Hart did that. I was one of a few people who worked with him privately in this group. He had a brief memo that he sent to the president in sort of in the fall of 2011, and Hart never heard back from Obama. One explanation for that is presidents are the busiest people on earth. 99% of what comes to them they never respond to. I think the other explanation is this just didn't seem important enough in the panoply of American politics for the president to make it a priority.
And yet, your recommendations, how could they be more important than this, to appoint a commission to assess the long wars, to clarify the decision-making process for using force? How important does it need to be? That's pretty important.
I agree, and I think there, you know, economists have the concept of demand versus effective demand. Demand is if you need effective demand is if you have money that you can pay for the food. In politics, this might mean demand is an issue that should be addressed. Effective demand is whether actually it's politically important enough to do so.
James Fallows is our guest this hour. We're lucky to have him today. His piece, it's the cover story of The Atlantic this month, is a very important one, and it's been getting a lot of attention. The tragedy of the American military, the American public and its political leadership will do anything for the military except take it seriously. The result is a chicken hawk nation in which careless spending and strategic folly combine to lure America into endless wars. It can't win. Here's our phone number. Join the conversation. We'd love to hear from you. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. We've posted James Fallows' article on our Facebook page. You can find it elsewhere on the internet now. It's just been published and is definitely worth a read. To you in a moment, this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. James Fallows is our guest this hour. His important piece, the cover story of the current issue of The Atlantic, and we're welcoming phone calls for him. We'll start with Karen in Prairie du Chien. Hi, Karen.
Hi, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I hope I can say this and be clear. I have a question. I wonder how much the press coverage in the last 20 years or so affects how well the military is able to do their job. The press seems to demand every little detail, and they're quite critical of every little detail. And in the past, it was a case of loose lips sink ships, and it seems like a big change. And I'm wondering if that has anything to do with it.
James.
I understand the question that Karen's raising, and I think there are the press is surprisingly aware of the concept of operational secrecy and the ways in which certain details need to be protected. My own judgment, which could be biased as a member of the press who's been following these issues for a long time, is that if anything, over the last 15 years, the press has been more careful and less intrusive in these ways during actual operations than in the past. And I'll use this illustration. After some previous wars, certainly in World War II, also Korea and Vietnam, there was a lot of press scrutiny of the actual operational competence of military leaders. Does generals make the right decisions, et cetera? In the Iraq-Afghanistan era, there's been less of that critique of competence and military skill and more just a sort of personal behavior issues, whether there's financial misconduct, sexual misconduct. I mentioned in the article that the two famous cases of prominent generals having to leave commands, General Petraeus from the CIA, General McChrystal from Afghanistan, both involve not military competence issues, but these sort of personal discipline issues. So I understand what Karen is saying. My own perhaps biased assessment is that this is not a major force of a major source of what's been going wrong.
Well, let's take that a step further, because you're writing about issues that you would think the press would be on virtually every day in this country. And that's an examination of how we're fighting ISIS. It would look very carefully at the F-35 and the use of technology fighting a foe who tends to be a little better than we are. And they don't have nearly the amount of money or any of the technology. And yet they're outsmarting us. You would think that it would be a constant coverage by the press. And it doesn't appear to be.
You would think that, and so on the F-35, there have actually been a lot of good exposés that various news organizations, PBS has done things, lots of newspapers have. They haven't gotten traction, I think, in public consciousness the way, say, the problems of the Obamacare rollout did, or Solyndra, or whatever else.
Yes.
And I think I agree with your premise, and the way I'd connect it to the argument I'm making in my piece is I'm saying that in the last 15 years, as fewer and fewer Americans have been actually involved in the wars that are going on, we, and I think to a degree the press, have substituted just declaring people in the military to be heroes for any kind of critical engagement with the goods and bads of what they do. And so I think that has spilled over to some press coverage, too.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Bob is next. Hi, Bob.
Hi, how's it going?
All right, Bob, how are you?
I'm good.
Good.
I was just calling because, I mean, I may be biased as a reservist myself, but I was curious what your thoughts are on the tendency for the American public and typically media sources as well, depending on which ones you read, to have a distaste for the use of drones. I mean, personally, again, as a service member, I find them very, very useful in kind of, I guess, saving American lives. And you also have to wonder, on that same note, I mean, how many lives do they actually save? Because obviously you do have unnecessary civilian casualties and isolated cases, well, not necessarily isolated cases, but in some cases that may happen. But, you know, obviously you're saving American lives by not putting soldiers' lives at risk. And even if you put soldiers in there, you still might have civilian casualties. But regardless, I just wanted to kind of ask you how you feel about perception on drones.
Thanks, Bob.
So I think that that's a very good illustration of the kind of question that, that Americans in general, not just people serving in uniform, should be discussing, because I'll use this historical analogy. My father was in the Navy at the end of World War II, and he and all of his colleagues understood the very deep moral debates about the morality and effectiveness of using the atomic bomb. And, you know, I've lived in Japan for quite a while. The trade-off of the civilian horrors in Japan for I would think, larger number of lives of American, Japanese, in other words, that were saved by not having the war go on any longer than it did. That was a first-order moral argument and military argument and strategic argument, and it's one in which the American public and the world public was genuinely engaged. I think the use of drones raises similar questions. To me, in a short-term tactical sense, they obviously are a huge advantage for the United States. As Bob says, they save American lives. You're not having people there on the ground. You can selectively eliminate targets, and often you can do so with less civilian damage than would be involved in a normal military operation. I think there are also serious long-term strategic questions for the United States about the ways in which the balance between the short-term advantages to us and long-term, as they say, blowback exposure we may be creating for ourselves. We're not going to have a monopoly of drones in the long run. Many other countries will have them. How will we feel when these attacks can be waged on us? I think that is a serious question that all of the public should be involved in. I'm not assuming the answer, but I'm saying it would be better if people other than Bob and his colleagues in uniform were debating these issues.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you watch Homeland, but I've been an avid viewer of that show for years now, and this year was really interesting in the amount of attention that was paid to creation of terrorists, more of them because of those American drone strikes that may have gone wrong. Has anybody investigated that?
I think that there's a book called, whose name I forget, by a sci-fi writer whose last name is Suarez, Daniel Suarez, came out about a year ago. It was talking about, it was imagining a future 10 or 15 years from now when everybody has drones and Americans are saying, why on earth did we rely on these so much? David Ignatius, a writer for the Washington Post, has also written a novel on these same grounds. I know that people within the military have thought about what will happen when we're not the only people with this technology, when the Chinese have it, ISIS has mm-hmm. it, or whatever. So I think it is an issue we all need to pay attention with. Homeland, I watched for a season, and I thought, this is getting too crazy.
Well, you need to watch this season, James.
Okay.
This season was the best of all. It really was. I recommend it. Thanks very much, Bob, for your call. And we go next to Rick in Monona. Hi, Rick.
Hi. I'm enjoying your program, as usual.
Thank you.
I'm a Vietnam veteran. And back during Vietnam, I turned against the war, and then I turned against the draft. I thought the draft was unfair. And since then, and watching the all-volunteer military, and now I realize that the volunteer military is sort of a failure. I don't think Americans, when there's a volunteer military, really have any stake in the game. They've because there's no draft, it really doesn't affect neighborhoods and families and fathers and mothers across the nation. And during Vietnam, I think that that's one of the things that everybody had, and that was a stake in the game. It turned people against the war. They paid a lot more attention to what was going on. I remember all the songs, the anti-war songs. I mean, the arts were paying attention to it. And as far as Iraq and Afghanistan, it seems like people are just pretty much ignoring it because they really don't have anybody that they know that's risking their lives over there. And I have one more comment about the voluntary military or the draft, and that is one of the things that I noticed when I went in the Navy and my friends that got drafted into the Army, and that is it really brings people together for a time. People from across the country go in and serve, and they're different colors and different religions, and it really does serve as a mixing point for people that are in isolated neighborhoods, the South and the North, and everybody gets a chance to sort of get a look at each other and be part of something with somebody that they may not have had any experience with before.
Mm-hmm.
So those are my two comments.
Thank you. Very interesting comments. Thanks very much, Rick. James.
Yes, I think these are extremely important comments that Rick has made, and let me just address some of them in a range of ways. First, the Atlantic, the same issue that has my article, has an article by Joseph Epstein, who is a very famous literary critic who was in the sort of post-Korean War era of the draftee army. And he makes points very much like Rick's, which is that he had experiences there with a cross-section of America he would never have met in other ways. That is one point. The democratizing effect of the post-World War II draft was profound. A second point to make is that the effect Rick is talking about in the shift to a volunteer army was entirely the intended effect when Richard Nixon was engineering this shift in the late 1960s, early 1970s. The main drag on the Vietnam War was disruption caused by the draft. I wrote 40 years ago this month, an article in the Washington Monthly called "What Did You Do in the Class War, Daddy?" about the unfairness of the way the draft worked, even when there was a draft in Vietnam. I was an undergraduate at Harvard during the late Vietnam years, and I talked about how everybody sort of situated like me found ways to skate past the draft, and people who were not at Harvard or MIT in those days were generally making up the drafted military. What was an unfairness of the draft then was sort of built into the volunteer force, where it's easier to manage, easier to command, produces less political kickback when there are unpopular wars. That is easier as a military matter, but I think it's worse as a democratic matter. Unfortunately, for better or worse, the United States is not going to have a draft again. It's just infeasible as a political question. So the issue then is how we can avoid having the pernicious effects that Rick accurately describes having a volunteer force.
Our phone number, there are lines open now. They've been crowded. James Fallows is our guest. He has the cover story in the current issue of The Atlantic. It is, "Why Do the Best Soldiers in the World Keep Losing? The Tragic Decline of the American Military." It's a very thorough article and getting a lot of attention, well-deserved attention in the country. And here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. James is the national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly and has worked for the magazine for many years. Paul sends this email, James: "Is the military captured by big business, by contractors, the way our finance system seems to be captured by big banks? Is there a revolving door there as well, or the incentive of private employment after retirement?"
Yes, it's different from the situation of regulatory capture with banks or whatever, because the motives of people joining the military are different, and the fraction of people who are involved is probably smaller too. But I talk in the article about a phenomenon that many serving military officers have observed, and that Jim Webb, former Democratic senator from Virginia, possible presidential candidate, a wounded Vietnam combat leader and a novelist, talks about, which is the way in which it's become more and more common for senior military officers, that is, generals and admirals on retirement, to go straight into business with military contractors, to go onto the boards of large defense contractors or get consulting contracts. And he says that has had an observable distorting effect. People see when they're in uniform the importance of the possibility that's open to them if they go into a job with one of these big businesses after they leave, and that it has to have some steering effect, some warping effect on the decisions they make on their way up.
Let's go to Ray in Milwaukee next. Hi, Ray.
Hi, I'd like to comment. Actually, I changed my mind on where I was going with my comment. I want to address the last three callers, starting with the draft. Isn't it obvious to everybody in this country right now that the War Powers Act should be changed? The first thing that should happen, if for whatever reason our president or George W. or whoever decides we're going to war, the first thing that should happen is that those leaders who are pushing that, their children should be number one with going into a draft with no exemptions, period. We should really be fighting for that, because if that's how we would have started going into Iraq or Afghanistan, I guarantee you things would have been different if Hillary Clinton's child had to go, if George W. Bush's child had to go, and if Dick Cheney's child had to go. It's a no-brainer.
James.
Yes, and in principle, I entirely agree. We need to find some way to make the connection between political decision-making and political consequences, in a literal sense, having skin in the game. In practical terms, with there being no draft in general, it's hard to say how you could have actual politicians' children be sent or define who is significant enough. But the general goal, I entirely agree with what Ray is saying. We have to close that feedback loop.
And we go to Tim next in Eau Claire. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I guess my question is, as Americans, we always say that we have the best this and the best that. We really don't have the best just about anything. Our educational system is poor. Just about everything is poor. And why do we think that we have the best military? If we're fighting a counterterrorism war right now, we really should look to, you know, a lot of our European countries, possibly even Israel, although I don't necessarily agree with what they do. But they all seem to be very good at fighting counterterrorism wars.
And so I understand the argument you're making, and I make a version of that in the piece, you know, trying to set up, and actually the title that Kathleen has been mentioning several times of why the best soldiers keep losing and why the best military keeps losing is examining that tension. On the range of ways in which the United States is dominant in the world, you're right that in healthcare we're only like number 50 or whatever. In education we have our strengths and weaknesses. The area of clearest U.S. dominance over the rest of the world is the overall gross strength of our military. The naval assets of the United States are without compare in the world, and the money we put into things is incomparable. U.S. The Air Force's aircraft are never involved in dogfights anymore because no one will fight them. You know, there's no other Air Force that can match them. But there's all this input and very little output in terms of achieving the things we would like to achieve strategically. And so that I agree with the premise of your question. We are spending an awful lot and buying a lot and risking a lot of lives and taking a lot of lives without achieving the things that the military is supposed to bring us.
Let's go back to one of the recommendations from that HURT working group. Nobody saw the report, but at least you can talk about it now, thank goodness.
And it's online, too, at The Atlantic.
Is it? Oh, great.
Yes.
Great. We'll put that on our Facebook page as well. Appoint a commission, one of the recommendations, to assess the long wars. Learn the lessons from Afghanistan and Iraq concerning irregular conventional conflict, command structures, intelligence effectiveness, indigenous cultural factors, training of local forces, effective combat unit performance. Are we doing any of that, James?
I think the answer, as with many things I've been saying, is yes, but not enough. Certainly, I know right this moment in the Pentagon and in all the combat commands, there are people going through lessons learned exercises and all the rest. So, yes, the military can say there are 16 things we're doing. We're teaching courses at the War College. We're having these books and studies. But in the largest sense, if people looked at the United States of this moment from a historical perspective and say this nation has been at war for 13 years, it should be paying much more formal attention to what it is doing than it has. Here would be an illustration. In the late 1960s, there was something called the Kerner Commission. There was a former, governor or senator from Illinois, Otto Kerner, who was in charge of a presidential commission examining what had gone wrong in race relations in American cities that was leading to all this violence. The answer, of course, traces back to slavery and beyond, but it was a formal examination. The 9/11 Commission, a more recent case, undertook a formal study of what had happened that made the United States vulnerable in the way it was in 9/11. A similarly formal examination of whether the wars of the last 13 years have done any good, and if so, why and how, and if not, why and why not. Right. So I think a much more formal inquiry that involves the public, even like the Space Shuttle Commission of the 1980s, is necessary.
Mm-hmm. Do you have confidence at all that we know what we're doing, that we have a clear plan in how to fight this threat that people say is going to be around for a long time, this ISIS threat?
My not being an expert on terrorism myself, but having written a lot about this in The Atlantic over the last dozen years, the starting point for my understanding is, number one, the damage that terrorists do is always through the reaction they provoke, not the immediate harm they do themselves. You know, even as devastating as the 9/11 attack was in 2001, the United States harmed itself more materially and lost lives and all the rest through what it did in response, its invasion to Iraq, than it withstood that day. And so I think the first point is, what is ISIS trying to get us to do? The second point is, what are the local assets we can work with in the Middle East who also have a stake in repelling this repellent force and moving on from there? So there are people, there is an established body of knowledge of how you deal with terrorism without letting yourself be whipsawed by terrorist groups.
James Fells, our guest this hour, his piece, current issue of The Atlantic, Why Do the Best Soldiers in the World Keep Losing? The Tragic Decline of the American Military. We're welcoming phone calls for him, and we thank you very much for yours. 800-486-8655 is our number. A line is open right now. If you're frustrated because you can't get through, send an email. We're getting to those on the air as well, and that's talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. James Fallows is here now, and we go to Jamie in Madison. Hi, Jamie.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Good.
Good. Go right ahead.
I spent 4 years in the military. I was in Iraq in 2003. I worked as a government contractor afterwards, and I have a combined 5 years spent in Iraq and Afghanistan. Mm. And I don't like hearing that we're losing the war, because I think we're choosing to leave because our media is not supporting us. We have so many options that we've not exhausted because as a military, we're weak. And part of that is because every time we make a move, the media is on top of us, and the civilians at home are crying that it's not fair play. But that's not been my experience over there. I mean, we're looking for an enemy that's not wearing a uniform, that could be walking down the streets pushing a shopping cart, and we'd have no idea. But if we try to defend ourselves, immediately people act like we're using too much force. A perfect example is, I was in Bagram 2 years ago when there was a big issue about us burning the Quran, and the people who worked at the garbage dump reached into the fires and pulled out the Quran. And the media was all over us, and there was a lot of violence outside the gates. People were throwing rocks at the soldiers, and they were burning tires, and we were not even allowed to fire a warning shot. But what the media never reported was that the inmates at the prison had been using the Quran to write messages to each other, and that's why we were burning it. And that was never in a single news article that I could find online.
What could we be doing, Jamie, from all your experience, all your years there, what could we be doing that would make everything better, that would make Iraq a safer place, a better place to live? What aren't we doing that we should?
our country doesn't understand that it's a culture that we're fighting. These people live in a very primitive environment, and they don't have a lot to live for. And I understand the draw to violence because it's kind of the only thing that they've got sometimes. And that's not going to change unless we change the entire culture, and we have to be dedicated to educating them. They don't want democracy. They don't know anything about it. They only care about their own family unit. They're not very loyal to their country. And the Taliban, a lot of times, is the only form of government that they've ever had. They're not interested in what we're offering them. And we're not fighting on their terms. They're very, very violent. And we're going in trying to fight a gentleman's war. You know, we're trying to find, you know, one bad guy in 100 and shoot him and not hurt anybody else. But they don't care. Every single American to them is an enemy. So they're fighting and they're winning because we can't really fight back on the same terms. We're educated and we're a society that's not going to allow somebody to just go in and blow up an entire city.
James.
So everything I've written over the last dozen years has been full of respect for the bravery and sacrifice of people who have been fighting for the United States and allied forces in Iraq and Afghanistan, and for the tactical victories they have scored. But I think Jamie very well presents the choice for the United States. If, as she says, it's a matter of fighting an entire culture, of being willing to have the same civilian casualties as the Taliban is willing to exert, and being there to fight essentially a pre-modern culture, by my strategic standards, that's not a fight the United States should engage, because in the long run, a country like ours cannot win that fight. I understand that people disagree. Jamie may entirely disagree, but that's a matter for political debate in the United States. If the battle is, as she correctly describes it, one about an entire culture, is that the kind of war the United States can choose and win in the long run? My own personal view is that we cannot win those in the long run. I understand that her view may be entirely opposite, but that's the kind of debate we should be having in the U.S.
Jamie, thanks so much for your call. Bill is next. Hi, Bill.
Hi, this is Bill from Barneville. Yeah, I'm going to amend my comment. I'm just feeling a little bit disturbed. I think Jamie, I'm grateful for her service, but I think she's got a lot of gall to say that Afghanistan is a culture of violence that we need to change. America invaded Iraq under a false pretense and killed 100,000 people. We killed 1 million in Vietnam. Whose is the culture of violence that needs to be changed? I traveled with the Mujahideen in Afghanistan in 1984 and 1985, and I can tell you I still some of my best friends are the Afghans I was with when they were fighting the Soviets. They're not an inherent culture of violence. There were no al-Qaeda when we invaded Iraq. We certainly created them since then. I have not served in the military, but I grew up watching, like a lot of people of my generation, watching the Vietnam War on Walter Cronkite, the CBS News every night. And I was 15 when the U.S. withdrew from Indochina in 1973, and it was just a great relief because I'd watched it on TV virtually every night of my life, the number of Americans killed and Vietnamese killed. And I thought, thank God, my country will never be stupid enough to do anything like that again. And the same people, you know, Cheney, Rumsfeld, did the exact same thing in Iraq. And so I think the answer to the question is, the question, why is the world's best military losing? Isn't it very simple? It's lack of commitment. The Vietnamese won because they understood what they were fighting for. They were defending a national struggle. They won because they wanted to. Americans had very unclear objectives in Vietnam. You know, we could have won militarily in Vietnam. We had the technical manpower in the army. Same thing in Iraq. I don't know why we're in Iraq. We went into Iraq for weapons of mass destruction, of which there are none. So, of course, Americans aren't behind the war in Iraq, and ISIS and others are much more motivated. They clearly going to have greater commitment to win, and that's why they're winning.
James.
Every study of war in the long run says that the moral qualities in warfare finally trump the material. You know, material advantage was America's huge strength in World War II, but there was no doubt about the moral commitment on our side. The Vietnamese, they had more at stake in Vietnam than Americans had at stake in Vietnam, so too in other parts of the world. So we lose. The most important fight factor in winning or losing wars is choosing the wars you engage in. And I think that's a lesson of Iraq.
Mm. The other thing that you mentioned, but it comes home to me every time I see, you know, a football game or a baseball game, or our American soldiers are always thought of as heroes and saluted at those games. And then during this holiday season, we as a family had some contact with the Milwaukee Vets Homeless Initiative. And there are people who fought these wars who were living under the bridges, you know, in the city of Milwaukee. So we have this juxtaposition of honoring, thank you so much for your service. We love you. We're going to have a song played to you at these major sporting events. And then all the people who are wounded, some beyond repair, or not all of them, but, you know, the people who we completely forget about who are living under the bridges.
The first third of my article or so, as you know, Kathleen, but maybe your listeners don't, is all about this phenomenon of what I consider the empty salute to the heroes rituals. And I got a note yesterday from somebody saying, as somebody who's now in uniform, saying when he hears thank you for your service or you're a hero, what he actually hears is get back in your foxhole.
Oh. Thanks, Bill, very much for your call. Let's go to Tim in Plainfield. Hi, Tim.
Hi, this is Jim in Plainfield. Number one, America doesn't know what a hero is anymore. We toss that term around. Let's go to Iraq. We should never have been in Iraq. People in the United States were lied to by George Bush, Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Paul Wolfowitz, Condoleezza Rice, and Colin Powell. And they should be held accountable, but unfortunately they never will. They should be accountable for the thousands of young men and women, American service personnel, who are killed. They should be held accountable for running the national debt from about $3 trillion over to $13 or $14 trillion. So they should be tried, and I'm sure they'd be convicted, and they should serve an appropriate sentence.
You mentioned the debt in your piece, how much the military contributes to our national debt. It's quite substantial, isn't it, James?
It is, and I don't have in front of me that part of the article, but the point I'm making is that if you have a full rendering of all the costs of our national security budget, the apparent ticket price is nearly $600 billion per year, or on the order of a billion and a half per day for the military. But if you take all the other costs, including veterans' pensions, the VA hospital system, and interest on the debt, it's about $1 trillion per year we spend on the military. Actually, it's about $80 billion a year just on interest on the military's part of the national debt. I did find that part of the article. And here's maybe a more interesting benchmark.
Sure.
The world as a whole spends about 2% of the world GDP on the military. The U.S. is an outlier, spending 4%.
Mm. Time for maybe one more phone call. Bob in Green Bay. Hi.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
James, very excellent paper, and you're a very articulate man bringing up important issues. My issue is, why does the United States have to get involved in all of these issues, all of these conflicts, real or imagined, all around the world? You don't see Switzerland next time there's a conflict in East Bum Crapistan. You don't see Switzerland calling the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines. We were lied into Iraq by that cabal the earlier caller mentioned. And I also have to agree with an earlier caller. If the sons and daughters of the people that lied to us to get us involved in these fiascos, these costly financial and all of the thousands of people we've lost, fiascos, and that's what they are, underline, italicize, highlight, boldface the word fiascos, we wouldn't be involved.
James.
I agree about the Iraq war. Before the war started, I was writing a lot of things in the Atlantic saying, don't do this, this is a mistake, it'll be a huge strategic error. I agree also, and I quote in my article Seth Moulton, a new Democratic congressman who served in Iraq, even though he opposed the war, and saying, if more people of prominence had been involved in this war, it just would never have happened. The public would not have been been in there. The United States is in a different situation from Switzerland. Switzerland is actually a fairly militarized country, but it's just for its own defense. There's a near universal draft there. Most people are part of the armed militia. A downside of being the world's largest power, as the United States is we get involved in more things, I'm saying that we just need to be way, way more discriminating about how we do it, and the first step towards that will be taking seriously the fate of the people who are carrying out these missions for us in uniform.
James, thank you so much for writing the article. You're just so thoughtful, and it was delightful to speak with you. Thank you.
Thanks so much. It's always a pleasure.
James Fallows, our guest. The piece that we've been talking about is the cover story of The Atlantic, the current issue of The Atlantic, just been released. It's on our Facebook page if you want to read it and find an easy place. And then you could leave a comment so we can keep the conversation going. The piece is titled, Why Do the Best Soldiers in the World Keep Losing? The Tragic Decline of the American Military. James has been writing about important issues, national security, policy, American politics, and more for a long time. He is national correspondent for The Atlantic Monthly. Thanks to Scotty Myers for producing this hour and to Scotty as well for on-air production in Milwaukee.